Being recorded. Welcome to our 11th symposium. And we have a copy of an issue today that was our most recent issue. It's on 1 Thessalonians, or we call it the Thessalonians. No, it's on Thessalonian correspondence. It includes both 1 and 2 Thessalonians. This was guest edited by Jeff Miller, who is to my left, your right, who is going to present on Friday. And in a moment, D.S. is going to introduce our presenter today. For the first time in 11 symposium history, which is about 20 years, we had two of our people in the last moment have to back out of being present to be with us. They're still going to have papers for the issue on the lectures, but they're not here. And therefore, Daryl Tippins has done a wonderful thing. He has consented to move from Friday when he was going to present, and he's going to present today. And I'm going to, if D'Essa wouldn't mind, would you introduce Daryl to our group?
Oh, I would be happy to introduce Daryl.
He agrees.
I had the great privilege of working with Daryl when he was here as the university provost. He served in that position, 10, 12 years?
Probably 14.
14 years. Wow, time goes by when you're having fun. I was having fun. I don't know about you, Daryl. But Dr. Tippins was the provost, which is the chief academic officer here at Pepperdine University. And he started just a little before I became the university chaplain. And when I became the university chaplain, I was in a position of getting to negotiate a lot of things about my job. And so I specifically requested, I don't know why, because I didn't know Daryl very well at the time, I requested to be able to report to the provost of the university. And so Daryl was my boss for those years that I served as chaplain. And it was a wonderful time together. And I learned about Daryl that he has great theological sensitivity and a great sense of worship and the planning of worship. And in fact, Daryl founded, I guess you would say, or began the a cappella conference that we have on this campus every 2 to 3 years, every 3 years. And if you have not, if you love a cappella singing and you haven't been to our a cappella conference, there's a flyer in your packet about that. You should plan to come 1 year. It's a wonderful experience. And but Daryl has his PhD in literature and taught literature at Abilene Christian University for a number of years before he came to us. And now he has returned to ACU, and he is the University Distinguished Scholar at Abilene, which means he gets to do just about anything he wants to do. And so that's a very fine thing. Daryl also has a great interest in spiritual formation and spiritual disciplines, and along with his interest in literature and theology and literature and faith. And so we're very pleased to have Daryl present for us on the symposium today. So come.
He will present for about 25 minutes. And then we're going to have a question and answer period. So you'll be thinking what you would like to ask.
Thank you, Stuart and D'Esta, for those kind words. It's really great to be with you. As I was thinking about how do I explain the bait and switch that just occurred, because some of you read the program and you were expecting to hear from James McCarty and Jennifer Bates, and I thought of that passage in Acts 19, you know, when those seven sons of Sceva tried to cast out demons, and the demon came back and said, "Jesus I know and Paul I know, but who are you?" I thought you may want to be saying, "Well, James McCarty I know, and I've heard of Jennifer, but who are you?" But thanks for being with us. What I'm going to be sharing is actually the text, more or less, of the article that you've asked for the publication. So if you'll bear with me, I'm actually going to read my my manuscript to you, but hopefully it will come through in a clear way. It was a day I shall long remember. It was January the 8th, 2007. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon when my assistant, Kathy Marshall, walked into my office. I had my desk facing away from the Pacific Ocean because it's so spectacular on the fourth floor of the administration building. I'd never get work done, so I was not facing the ocean. And she walked in and looked past me and looked surprised. So I turned around and saw what she saw. Just below us, a small brush fire had started at the very edge of the Pacific Coast Highway. Most likely, a careless motorist had tossed a burning cigarette out the window. It was one of those very dry, very windy days. Anybody who's been in Southern California very long knows what it's like when the Santa Ana's hit. The winds, in fact, were gusting up to 55 miles an hour that afternoon. The winds drove the fire with remarkable speed towards what is called the Malibu Bluffs, right below the campus, spilling over the bluffs onto the beach homes below. When the fire reached the home of Suzanne Summers, the house didn't just catch fire. According to the actress, her house exploded. Her precise words were these: "It was like a box of matches. It just went whoosh." James, the brother of our Lord, understood this phenomenon very well. Listen to James 3 from the Revised English Bible, James 3, 5 through 6. "What a vast amount of timber can be set ablaze by the tiniest spark. And the tongue is a fire, representing in our body the whole wicked world. It pollutes our whole being. It sets the whole course of our existence alight, and its flames are fed by hell." End quote. According to James, our world is like California today, suffering extreme drought. And we are like careless motorists, heedlessly tossing lit cigarettes out the window. In his letter, James is saying to Christians in general and to church leaders in particular, the tongue is as dangerous as any fire. It can make the whole world a life of blazing hell. That's the Phillips translation version of it. Watch your incendiary words. Only you, by the power of God, can prevent forest fires. Those are my words. For a few minutes, I invite you to consider the wisdom of James on the use of language. James was steeped in the wisdom tradition, in the literature of the Old Testament, but also the oral traditions of wisdom that were very common in the first century world, and almost certainly the literature of a book from the 2nd century BC, well known among Jews in James's time, called the Book of Wisdom of Sirach. Sometimes it's translated or called Ecclesiasticus. It's in the Greek Orthodox Tradition Bible and the Catholic Bible. This enduring wisdom deserves our attention. While these ancient authors lack our technological savvy, they are well ahead of us, I believe, on topics like how to live well in community, how to foster lasting relationships and resolve conflict. James, in particular, recognized the risks facing newly formed Christian communities. He understood that the well-being of the church depended on how people use their words. It's no exaggeration to say that for James, language is a life and death matter. We desperately need the wisdom of James on the tongue today. I believe we live in a very risky moment. We have the power to create and disseminate words around the globe at the speed of light. Yet paradoxically, we are largely oblivious to the teachings of wisdom literature on the power of words. James understood, words kill. So it is in our day, except our means of dropping destructive words in a million different places in a single moment has become the true weapon of mass destruction of our time. But well over 2,000 years ago, Jesus, son of Sirach, knew this, and I'm quoting from chapter 28. He said, "Many have been killed by the edge of the sword, but not so many as by the tongue." If you're like me, you grew up with a somewhat confused view of speech, of language. I, for example, was coached to underestimate, even to deny, the potency of words. I heard remarks like, "It's just words," or "He's all talk," or "It's just rhetoric." Worst of all, I was taught that childish but utterly false cliche, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me." I recited that empty incantation plenty of times, ironically using language to deny the power of language. What a paradox. It didn't work. Based on his own upbringing, British humorist Stephen Fry has revised a saying to, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will always hurt me." Fry's experience matches mine. I do not carry a single major physical scar from my youth, despite the many physical altercations with my 5 rambunctious siblings and my many playmates. But painful words spoken by a few have left their lasting marks on me, and they are not likely to fade, even in this lifetime. Sirach said it well, "The lash of a tongue will break bones. The death it inflicts is a horrible death." The wisdom of James and others in the wisdom tradition are emphatic. Words matter. And by the way, it's a truth that Jesus is extremely clear about. Matthew 12:36. "I tell you, on the day of judgment, you will have to give an account for every careless word you utter. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." Surely this is one of the hard sayings of Jesus. According to the Scientific American, on average we speak about 16,000 words a day. They actually put contraptions on students in several places over a period of months, and then literally measured the word output of hundreds of people to come up with that number. Multiply that number by the average life expectancy of a speaking person, we can skip infancy here, and you come up with about 450 million words that you will speak in your lifetime if you're the average person. Some of us have already beat that number, I'm sure, and I realize how many words I'm using right now. But it's sobering to imagine being required at the day of judgment to give account of every one of those words. Every word spoken aloud, whispered, telephoned, written, texted, emailed. If you're like me, you will be counting on God's grace when the celestial word check rolls around. We must resist the popular cultural notion that words are ephemeral, that they just evaporate into the ether. According to Jesus, words are forever. They last till judgment day. There is no erase. There is no delete button. I'd like to suggest some takeaways from listening to James's instruction, but also the instruction of this other wisdom literature that was circulating in the culture that Jesus lived in and James lived in. And by the way, there's a wonderful book out that just came out a couple of years ago called The Jewish Teachers of Jesus, James, and Jude, What Earliest Christianity Learned from the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. So even if you don't think of those books as canonical, they were there, and they were read. There's this like common literature that you and I know today. We don't count it as biblical, but it's in the culture. It's in the air. And so it was with Sirach. The first takeaway I have is that words are important because they reveal us. They reveal who we are. They are indexes to our souls. And the tongue, of course, is not really the problem here. When James talks about the tongue, he's employing a particular kind of metaphor. It's called a metonymy. In a metonymy, a term is used to stand for something else closely related to it. So an Englishman might say that the crown is in favor of a new immigration policy. And it's not the crown. It's the person who wears the crown that's being referred to, of course. Or here in Hollywood, a screenwriter might complain that the suits are messing up his script, meaning the people who control the money. The bean counters, another metonymy maybe, who are messing with his creative decisions. So the tongue in James is not the fleshy muscular organ in our mouths, but it's the inner person. It's the self, the soul that's driving that muscle in the mouth. Whatever is the true me, the self that operates the tongue, that's the problem. Jesus says it very clearly. He says, "For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good person brings good things out of good treasure, and the evil person brings evil things out of evil treasure." That's Matthew 12:34. My second observation is that words are mind-bogglingly potent. We might say they contain atomic power, but even this analogy is feeble. They have much more power than a split atom. And this makes sense because our Creator, the Logos, the Word, brought atoms into being through words. This Word chose words to communicate with us. And humans created in His image have been given a corresponding analogous gift of language. That we can speak, imagine, and create through language is indeed a sign of our divine nature. Interestingly, recent philosophers have argued that human speech itself is evidence of a divine origin. The Jewish philosopher Abraham Heschel beautifully articulates what I'm trying to say here about the connection between God, humanity, truth, and language. He wrote, "Some people may wonder, why was the light of God given in the form of language? How is it conceivable that the divine should be contained in such brittle vessels as consonants and vowels? This question betrays the sins of our age. To treat lightly the ether which carries the light waves of the spirit. What else in the world is as capable of bringing person and person together over the distances in space and in time? Of all things on earth, words alone never die. They have so little matter and so much meaning. It is as if God took these Hebrew words and breathed into them His power, and the words became a live wire charged with His spirit. To this very day, they are hyphens between heaven and earth." That metaphor has just been with me for decades. The link between us and God, God and us, are these hyphens. Heschel invites us to take words more seriously in the way that James does. The shelf life of words, according to Scripture, is forever. My third observation is we must fathom the dual power of words, almost the contradictory or paradoxical power of words. James is emphatic what vast potentialities they have, as it's expressed in the Phillips translation. George Steiner says it this way: "Speech that can articulate the ethics of Socrates, the parables of Christ, the master building of being in Shakespeare can, by exactly the same virtue of unconstrained potentiality, blueprint and legislate the death camps and chronicles of torture." Given his goal of empowering healthy Christian communities, James is focused on the negative power of words to destroy, primarily in chapter 3. And that is why he admonishes his audience, "Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger." 1:19. Intemperate words injure relationships. Cruel rhetoric wrecks congregations, destroys families, incites pogroms and terrorist attacks, and even genocide. It has been my privilege a couple of years ago to meet Immaculée Ilibagiza, who is a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. We had her come speak at the Christian Scholars Conference, and she wrote a book about it called Left to Tell. And she tells how that for days before the genocide began in Rwanda, it was radio speeches inciting hatred and violence that set the stage for the mass killings. There's a direct relationship between the hate speech on the radio and the breaking out of the genocide in Rwanda back in 1994. And so it was in the Middle Ages when rampant anti-Semitism led to the persecution of Jews. One of my friends years ago did a historical study for his doctoral dissertation showing that sermons against Jews in medieval Europe directly led to pogroms. And so you can find the same thing going on in Nazi Germany, of course. And so it is today with virulent rhetoric on extremist websites that are preludes to the murders of Christians in North Africa and throughout the Middle East. but one not need be a terrorist or an anti-Semite or a racist or a warmonger to be complicit in verbal destruction. All over the internet, you will find articles with titles like these: 6 ways social media can ruin your life, or 7 ways email can get you fired. Did you know that half of America's companies have fired workers for email or internet abuse? In a recent article on 13 of the most common reasons for a person likely to be fired, I just went through and read them, and I counted 5 of them relate specifically to things people say or write. The tongue can ruin a career with lightning speed. I want to go back to Sirach, written 2 centuries before the life of Christ. He said, "Happy are those who are sheltered from the tongue's onslaught, who have not been exposed to its fury, who have not borne its yoke or been chained with its fetters." End quote. The danger has been compounded in our day by the advent of ubiquitous social networking, smartphones, and email. In ancient times, for a bad speech to get you into trouble, it had to be spoken and loud enough for somebody to hear it. And there were no hidden microphones or mics that are left on inadvertently. There were no electronic airwaves to broadcast your idle mutterings to the far reaches of the planet. Even if your remarks were heard, for them to travel widely, someone else would have to go to some effort to repeat them or record them on papyrus and vellum or wax or clay tablet. By the way, if you haven't been to the biblical exhibit yet in the top floor of the library, be sure you go and just look at the effort it took to produce words that would last 500 years, 1,000 years, or 2,000 years. It was a lot of trouble to record them. It's no trouble at all today, is it? Getting your slip-ups or your thoughtless insult to spread was possible back then, but it wasn't easy by today's standards. And yet look at the dangers and the warnings these ancient texts give us. Today, those 140 characters in a tweet can circle the globe in a flash and render one's life a shambles. Recent headlines illustrate this point. If you haven't seen the New York Times article, "How One Stupid Tweet Blew Up Justine Sacco's Life," I encourage you to just Google it. It's an amazing story of a woman who's on a flight from Europe to South Africa, and she tweets one ill-advised joke. And she meant it to be an innocent joke. She was not at all trying to be racist, but before her plane could land, in just a matter of hours, her tweet had gone around the world, and she was fired, lost her career. She suffered global humiliation in just minutes. So apocalyptic judgment may not wait until the second coming of Jesus. It can come instantly these days. These individual mini massacres that we do on others and we do even on ourselves occur daily without ever making it into the news. They still happen in the old-fashioned way, too, without smartphones. Who doesn't know the pain of being the target of thoughtless words or an ill-conceived jibe? George Steiner says this. He says, "In words, as in particle physics, there is matter and there is antimatter. There is construction and annihilation. Parents and children, men and women, when facing each other in exchange of speech, are at ultimate risk. One word can cripple a human relationship, can do dirt on hope." End quote. To this very day, I wince when I recollect my father's negative critique of me when I was a high school student. My dad was a high school teacher. Though I was an outstanding student, still I didn't measure up to his expectations. What he said cut deeply, and it took a long time to heal. My father mellowed over time. He became a more loving and supportive man. But that hurtful remark left its mark. Steiner says, "The knives of saying cut deepest." James does not mince words here. The tongue is a restless evil full of deadly poison. Sirach is also emphatic. He writes, "The tongue will kindle a fire and it will never be extinguished." Sounds a lot like James, doesn't it? "Limit the damage with this, a self-imposed gag order, wisdom tradition teaches. Sirach says, make for your mouth a door that locks. Another translator puts it this way, put a door with bolts across your mouth. The psalmist says, muzzle your mouth. My fourth observation, there is good news here too, and that is the redemptive power of words, which I believe supersede their potential for harm. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be talking today. Words can hurt, but they heal and bless as well. In fact, blessing is on James's mind. His point is, that's what your tongue is for, is not to curse, but to bless. That's the real subject, I believe, of James. Steiner writes, yet the identical instrument of language is that of revelation or ecstasy, of the wonder of understanding, that is communion. While it's natural to focus on the dangers of the tongue, especially when we're reading the third chapter of James, I think the greater insight is the powerful, positive influence of language. After all, the very survival and universal availability of James's letter that we're considering right now, something that is available in hundreds of languages over two centuries, shouts the fundamental truth that words can encourage, nourish, and save over vast expanses of time and great distances. Language is one of God's greatest gifts to us. What joy and comfort we receive as we share, plead, inform, entertain, praise, and pray. As we read and meditate upon and respond to James's own letter, though written almost 2,000 years ago, it's nourishing us now. Isn't that a kind of miracle? Just as God spoke creation into being in the beginning, we who bear his image are called to speak creatively and productively too. Language has performative power, which is to say that it actually changes things. Just as the minister's marriage service speaks something into being, a new union, a marriage, the language of blessing also changes reality. The right words spoken in faith and love become vehicles of grace. Paul said this in Ephesians 4:29, let no evil talk come out of your mouths, but only what is useful for building up, as there is need, so that your words may give grace to those who hear. Note the parallel between what God does for his creatures, granting grace, and what you and I are called to do, to grant grace through seasoned speech. It is common today to talk about the coarsening of discourse and culture. We swim in bitter and profane rhetoric of our pop culture. Christians of all people must counter the effects of that verbal waste. Scripture and the ancient traditions of spirituality offer a number of useful strategies for coping. And let me mention a few in conclusion. The first is simply to speak less, to renounce verbal profligacy. So if I get my 16,000-word allotment today, I wonder how I'm doing right now. Maybe I'll need to be quiet really soon. Ancient Christians knew that less is more when it comes to speech. And there's just, if you get into any of the traditions of Christian spirituality, the caution about language is all through them, whether it's Benedict or whomever. The psalmist says in Psalm 39:1, I will keep a muzzle on my mouth. The Proverbs 10:19 says, a flood of words is never without its faults. So speaking less. Number two, practicing better conversational etiquette. James tells us to be quick to listen and slow to speak, 1:19. Sirach offers some wonderful advice. I would just love this to be recited aloud on CNN or Fox. This is Sirach chapter 11, verse 8. Do not answer without first listening. And do not interrupt while another is speaking. Maybe we ought to reconsider whether that should be canonical. How would talk shows and radio and cable TV change if guests were bound by that, those basic rules of listening before you speak? Number three, we could offer regular courses of study in our congregations about the proper use of the tongue. And I don't think I've ever heard of a course of study that's about how to speak as Christian men and women. What if we were guided by the teachings of James and the Gospels and Paul's letters and wisdom literature in general on this topic, on this matter? Topics could cover things like how to communicate properly on social networks, how to avoid inflaming hostility, how to participate in difficult conversations, how to use words to bless. What if we were taught how to invoke blessings on others? Class members might learn the lost art of handwritten notes. I mean, I got a handwritten note right before class started. I had to read it because to get a handwritten note is spectacular these days. It's so rare. Personal phone calls. I read recently about a company where their sales had plummeted and they couldn't figure out why. And it turns out they had hired a whole generation of young people who were so used to texting, they thought they could make sales just by texting and not talking to anybody. And they had to go back and train their employees how to pick up a phone and have a conversation with another person on the other end. Imagine that. Maybe we even need to train people to have face-to-face conversations. Another point, we should study and practice the biblical art of blessing. Blessing is not some magical, weird, antiquated practice. According to Walter Brueggemann, a blessing is, and I quote him here at length, a blessing is an act by speech or gesture whereby one party transmits power for life to another party. This act of transmission, which occurs in a world of intense interpersonal relationships, is not explainable in any positivistic terms. Viewed theologically, the transmission takes on the quality of the sacramental so that more happens than can be explained. It's beyond rational analysis, end quote there. A blessing is not merely wishing someone well. It is a bestowal of something of value on them. When Jesus confers the title, for example, and this is one of my favorite passages, Luke 13, daughter of Abraham, calls this woman who is poor, ill, mistreated, and culturally marginalized, he says, this woman is a daughter of Abraham. He has given her life-altering dignity. He has made her the equivalent of a princess among these people who had completely ignored her. He says, should not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound for 18 long years, be set free on the Sabbath from what has bound her? What a blessing. Living in an age of verbal violence, Christians must be known for gracious speech that flows from transformed hearts, to be sure that we are known for eulogia, the good word. It's not something we just do at a funeral. It's something we do every day to those around us, blessing others, praising God, practicing speech. Václav Havel, the former liberator and president of the Czech Republic, said, one word of truth outweighs the entire world. And that led me to another memory of a great message from the Polish man and poet Czesław Miłosz, who suffered first under the tyrannies of Nazis when they invaded Poland, and then subsequently decades under Soviet oppression, where so much lying went on, as a matter of course, in all parts of life. He once said, in a room where people unanimously maintain a conspiracy of silence, one word of truth sounds like a pistol shot. Language is powerful. Although Scripture is the preeminent source of blessing, one should consider the possibility that models of blessing can be found all around us in all sorts of ways. I find blessing in the rich language of poets like George Herbert and John Milton and John Donne, in the hymns of Charles Wesley, in the litanies of the Book of Common Prayer, in the essays of Simone Weil and Blaise Pascal, in the letters of Flannery O'Connor, in the fiction of Leo Tolstoy or Marilynne Robinson. Good biography and autobiography can do this as well, as in Laura Hillebrand's recent biography, Unbroken, The Amazing Life of Louis Zamperini. And I want to end with a story about Louis Zamperini. Just a few months before he passed away, Pepperdine University hosted a reception for him. in Santa Monica. It was a fundraising event for the library, and I was not able to attend, I'm sorry to say, because Louis was there. But the dean of our library, Dean Mark Russa, managed to get Mr. Zamperini to inscribe a copy of the book, Unbroken, for me. And in the front of the book, he simply wrote, "To Daryl, be hearty. Be hearty. Louis Zamperini." That's had a strange effect on me. Considering that man's long journey in teenage delinquency, read the book, please, or see the movie or do both, being lost at sea in horrendous conditions, starved and tortured unmercifully in a POW camp, falling into alcoholism after he comes home, and then committing his life to Jesus Christ. Those words, in that context, to say, be hearty, have been a blessing to me. Because I have my hardships, you have yours. But to imagine, he went through all that, and he's telling me, be hearty. You know, hang in there. You know, stand fast. Be loyal. Whatever. Those words are like prophecy to me, and instruction, and blessing, all at once. As my father lay dying last October, many years after I had heard his harsh and uncaring words, it was I who was able to bless him as he made his journey into the next life. At the end, all I could offer him in his hour of extremity were my presence and my words of affection. That, it seems to me, is what we can all do for one another. We can offer our presence and our blessing. Thank you.
Let's see, pause here, and let's see if we have questions you would like to ask Daryl. Do you have any? If you don't, I got one or two myself. Okay.
Daryl, in the very beginning of your presentation, and then you carried it on out and illustrated it even further in the end, you used a phrase that is that we live in a risky time.
Yeah.
Because our words can so quickly circle the globe. And I've been wrestling with that lately myself, partly because of the presentation I'm making in the morning. And what troubles me so much about the culture we live in now is that we're developing a culture of hate. Mm-hmm. And those words come by people that are, quote, our friends on Facebook. But I don't even know who they are, most of them, you know. But they're vicious,
yeah,
and hateful things that are being said about people that we have always been taught to respect.
Yeah.
And it just spills forward out of that to, yeah, other expressions. So what is your, I'm asking you to read your paper again.
Yeah. There's a lot here we need to work on together, it seems to me. If we were to develop that curriculum for a class, like I was thinking, I think we could come up with some great topics for conversation that could be very specific and very concrete. I don't do very much Facebooking, and so people ignore me because I'm so bad at it, I think. And so I don't see some of the hate speech or read the hate speech that you're describing, but I know it's there. I do know a friend recently just said he had to unfriend somebody because
of
her.
Well, I wish you'd tell me how. I would like to do that.
There's a way to do that. But I think that would be a very powerful statement. It's not shaming. You're not berating. But you could just simply say, you know, I can't do this. And I think, you know, back to my Vaclav, not Vaclav Havel, but the Czeslaw Milosz quote, in a room where there's a conspiracy of silence, one word of truth can sound like a pistol shot. Mm-hmm. I think in a culture where everybody's saying these awful and base things, someone just standing up and saying, I'm sorry, I don't talk like that, and I don't need to hear that kind of language,
mm-hmm,
I think that's the pistol shot.
Right.
You know, I think if James was here, that he would say, I understand everything, I hear you in depth, And yet the letter itself
is
filled with prophetic-like indictment of harshness that runs to the core, and which raises the question, the legitimacy of then harsh language.
Yeah.
Of analysis, of prophetic speech, I guess, maybe another way to express it.
I've thought a lot about that because I'm hitting the blessing side, and chapter 3 is pretty much a judgment and judgmental. The commentaries on it, people like Scott McKnight and others, I think, have convinced me that James is really dealing with some very difficult situations as they're trying to found these Christian communities in a very difficult environment, mm-hmm. and things are at great risk, and he sees this as the real challenge at the moment, you know, and I think that's part of what I would say. To me, it's a balancing act here. There is a time to call for prophecy and judgment and correction. So I'm not wanting to suggest that Christianity means that we just go around just saying nice things to everybody, that we become the Hallmark card church, with pleasant thoughts and sweet thoughts. But there is a matter of tempering it, and I think it's being very thoughtful about how to get a reception for what needs to be said at the time, and understanding your situation, where you are. And of course, what we're seeing today is so cowardly because the terrible speech that's in social networking is cowardly because you're not having to look into the eyes of the person to whom you're speaking. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's impersonal, and it's a cheap shot. You're not held accountable. Well, you are now because there's so much shaming that's going on in certain cases where the blowback is so strong. But the truth is, many people are, quote, getting away with it. So it seems, because it's impersonal. They would never say. And I've seen this in the workplace, by the way, where people would never say to one another in a one-on-one conversation what they said in an email. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stories from Pepperdine several years ago is one of my colleagues had two employees under him who were fussing at each other back and forth by email. And they officed in the same area. I mean, they were just feet from each other. But they were emailing each other, and their emails were getting more and more hostile with each exchange. And so the boss intervened and forbade them to email for a period of days or weeks and said, you have to talk to one another face to face. And the dispute went away. It evaporated once they talked to each other. But there's a way in which you're unrestrained at that keyboard.
Yeah.
Many people feel that. And I think that's every tool. It's like an automobile. An automobile is a marvelous invention. I wouldn't want to live without mine. But automobiles on PCH kill people because people drive too fast and do dangerous things like text or drink. And so what is a wonderful tool is a weapon of extraordinary destruction. And so it is with all technology, it seems to me. It has a shadow side. And the people who sell the technology have no reason or rationale to tell you the dark side, the shadow side. It's not their business to tell you how dangerous they're selling you an object. Their goal is just to sell you more of them. So who is speaking up about the shadow side of technology without turning into being Luddites? I think that'd be another great topic to have a conversation. Because I am pro-technology. You know, Apple owns too much of me. Okay, but I think I'm aware of its dangers in ways that maybe some of our younger people are not, and we've got to think about it, talk about it.
You mentioned about the possibility or the thought of churches engaging in class to teach members how to speak to one another. And I think certainly the base of that is when Jesus says it's not what goes in a man that defiles him, but comes out. Ability to teach our people how to speak to one another, you know, hinges upon the fruit of the Spirit, that quality of meekness, kindness. It's based upon the base of your motivation for speaking and what you want to do. So equipping our members to walk in that spirit of humility and meekness becomes the basis of teaching them how to speak.
Do you see a kind of circularity here that's not
a vicious circle, but it's a virtuous circle, that practice can help shape how your heart feels, and your heart then should shape your practice. And it's not one or the other, but it's this, seems to me that's what spiritual formation is all about, that I may sing a hymn that when I start singing it, I don't feel exactly the sentiments of the hymn when I start singing, but before I'm finished with the hymn, the actual singing of it has changed me in some way. So I don't need to wait around till I feel right and it's holy mood before I sing the hymn. The actual physical action of singing is changing my heart. And then my heart is, it's called tuning the heart. And so the heart gets tuned just like the voice gets tuned.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow...